Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Hello, everybody. No Chicago with us now, just us in the New York metro area, just us few people. The last time Mark Kleinman was on the program, he said that nobody knows what a world where marijuana is legal looks like. How could people buy it? And how much would it cost? Where could people use it? And what's the appropriate penalty for abuse? Well, now Washington State is that world, and guess who's helping state officials shape it? And yes, there are some growing pains. Mark Kleinman is a professor of public policy at the UCLA School of Public Affairs. He joined us on the program last year, some of you will remember, to talk about the book he co-authored, Marijuana Legalization, What Everyone Needs to Know. And now he's in our studios, this time as Washington State's regulatory leader for marijuana. Professor Kleinman, welcome back to WNYC.
Brian, thanks very much.
So you're referred to in many places in the media as Washington State's pot czar, but you've got a real job teaching at UCLA. Other people might call themselves a pot czar, but that might be a bit of a delusion.
Right.
I'm a pot czar. But do you? But seriously, you've got a serious responsibility on your hands. What's your job exactly? What is your role in Washington State?
Yes. Well, I'm glad to be the pot czar, otherwise known as the Emperor, and you may address me as Your Highness. But in real life,
what a sense of humor in government.
Exactly. Well, but see, I'm not in government except that I work for UCLA. I'm part of a team of about 40 people who are going to be advising the Washington State Liquor Board, which is the regulatory agency under the new law, about what to do. So we are not making decisions. We're not actually making recommendations. We're going to try to tell the board, look, you can do A or B or C. And here are the advantages and disadvantages of doing A, of doing B, of doing C. Now make up your mind. And that's basically our role. So czardom is pretty distant.
And to remind our listeners, you're helping the state roll out regulations that comply with Initiative 502, which passed last November to legalize marijuana. So how far does that go? Is it sales, dealing, enforcement?
Well, it's the whole nine yards. They're going to license growers, processors, and retailers. It's the same three-tier distribution you have for alcohol, which was the design in the law. Now, notice legal is slightly a stretch. It'll be legal under Washington law. It'll still be illegal under federal law. So the state's in the position of licensing people to commit federal felonies, and that's going to be a complicated negotiation with the federal government. I don't even think the board's involved with that. I think that's happening at the level of the governor's office, and we're not advisors to that.
And listeners, if you have any questions for my guest, Mark Kleinman, in his unique consultancy, now leading Washington State's marijuana regulatory efforts or consulting on them, 212-433-WNYC. Anything you're wondering about how to implement marijuana legalization or how it's working out so far since that referendum passed in November in Washington State, as well as in Colorado, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. And so let me ask you just some basic questions. You say there are going to be retail licensees.
Right.
So are there going to be pot stores in Washington State like there are liquor stores today?
Precisely. And they will only be pot stores. So unlike beer and wine, which can be sold in grocery stores and convenience stores, under the law, cannabis can only be sold in cannabis-only locations, and all they can sell is cannabis, including edibles and equipment.
And have people
But not Doritos. They can't sell the Doritos.
Renting the Doritos, no actual munchies to go. That's not considered part of the supplies.
Apparently not.
And have people started renting storefronts already and, establishing the first model of what a pot store will look like?
They can't do that until they get a license from the board, and they can't do that until the board has issued regulations. That's the process we're advising on. And it may be a little bit slower than people in Washington had hoped. They have to issue licenses to grow, and then people actually have to grow the stuff, and then there have to be retail stores.
So they can only legally sell legally grown marijuana, which means it has to be grown in Washington State?
Has to be grown in Washington State. I think they're going to have to decide where they grandfather in the stuff that's being grown currently under the medical law in Washington State. Washington State has a fairly wide open medical production and distribution system. And how to meld that into the new commercial system is a very difficult and tricky question.
But do you expect then different brands to spring up and different strains that can all be grown legally? You know, are we going to see the equivalent of tequila versus bourbon versus beer versus wine?
I'm sure we'll see different strains. And one of the things the board has to decide is what testing to require and what goes on the label. Cannabis is a much more complicated drug than alcohol, right? I mean, the psychoactive content of beer is ethyl alcohol, and if I say it's 5% alcohol, now you know everything you need to know about the psychological effect of the beer. How it tastes is a different question.
And when Maker's Mark wanted to reduce the alcohol in their bourbon from, I think it was 43% to 40%, it was a big firestorm, and it was very public knowledge.
Right. But that's all you really needed to know. I mean, maybe there's some aldehydes in brandy, but not apparently significant. Cannabis, I mean, 10 years ago, if you'd read the scientific literature, you would have learned that the active agent in cannabis was delta-9 THC, just as the active agent in beer is ethyl alcohol. That turns out to be wrong. At least it's a half-truth. Mm-hmm. There are 40 cannabinoid molecules in cannabis smoke, at least three of them, THC, cannabidiol or CBD, and cannabinol or CBN, are active, and they're interactive. So cannabidiol buffers the effects of THC. It's a competitor at the receptor site, but it also seems to have some anti-anxiety properties, while THC itself promotes anxiety. Hmm. So that's the reason that people – a lot of people now complain, people my generation who had pot in college, complain that if they smoke contemporary pot, they get paranoid with it because it's a lot of THC and not very much cannabidiol at all.
So will it be the role of the state to say what ingredients must be, may be, or may not be in legal marijuana?
They could decide that, or they could decide to require testing and labeling. And then the question is, what goes on the label? I mean, not 40 cannabinoids plus a bunch of terpenes. The consumer couldn't
right.
understand that.
So you're the consultant. What would you recommend goes on the label?
We haven't done that analysis yet. It seems to be one reasonable thing to say is you've got to tell them how much THC is in it, right? That's the intoxicating agent. And you've got to tell them the ratio of THC to cannabidiol, which is the buffer. So basically how strong it is. And I think of that ratio as basically how risky it is. The higher the ratio, the more likely you are to wind up with a panic attack. Hmm. And, you know, maybe we could have a color code on the label. Remember, what's complicated about cannabis policy is that it's discussed mostly by people like you and me with advanced degrees. Mm-hmm. It's used mostly by people without high school educations. 60% of all the use days of cannabis in the U.S. are people who don't have a high school diploma. And so we have this weird conversation among highly educated people about what's now a fairly downscale behavior. Mm-hmm. And I keep pulling people back from the discussion of the way they and their friends used pot in college to the contemporary real world.
212-433-WNYC for Mark Kleiman from UCLA, who's helping Washington State to implement its new legal marijuana law. And let's take a call from Daryl in Newton, New Jersey. Daryl, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hello. How are you, Brian?
What's your question?
My question is about driving under the influence. I understand that there's a rule that law enforcement is still going to be looking for people driving under the influence. And I'm just wondering if there's an initiative to test people's impairment instead of just simply, you know, finding them when, you know, honestly, I don't think it's any worse than driving under the influence of tobacco.
Tobacco? You mean alcohol?
No, I'm talking about marijuana.
Right. You don't think driving under the influence of marijuana is any more dangerous than driving under the influence of tobacco? Is that what you really meant to say?
Well, that's what I mean to say. My question is, is there going to be an initiative in Washington to stop penalizing for people for driving under the influence? I understand now, as the law exists, it's equivalent mm-hmm. to, you know, driving under the influence of alcohol.
Right. And, of course, we take drunk driving very seriously in this country these days. How are they going to regulate driving under the influence of marijuana?
That's set out in the law. It was essentially in polling around the initiative, they decided they had to say what they're going to do about stoned driving.
That was in the referendum.
In the referendum.
That they are going to have to, in some way, deal with stoned driving laws.
It's actually in the referendum how they have to do it. There's a
there's a nanogram per deciliter of blood limit that's a per se driving while intoxicated. Now, that's really pretty problematic because, again, cannabis is unlike alcohol. Alcohol is water-soluble. It's in the blood. It comes out in breath. If I measure your breath, I know what's in your bloodstream. And if it's in your breath, it's in your bloodstream. THC is not water-soluble. It's fat-soluble. So if you've got it in your bloodstream, it goes into fat cells, and then it comes back out. So 3 days later, you're still going to be positive for THC, even though you're not subjectively impaired at all.
In fact, employers often do drug tests that include marijuana, and they take blood, right? Or they take urine, and I think I've heard that you have to pretty much go clean for 2 weeks if you're a regular marijuana smoker in order not to test positive for pot on one of those things. I don't know if that's an accurate perception.
That's a fairly accurate perception. 2 weeks might not actually be enough. Those tests are mostly testing for metabolites rather than cannabis than THC itself.
So indicators.
Well, they're basically the breakdown products.
Yeah.
The law specifies testing for the active agent. That was intended to mean, well, if the person's got the active agent on board, they must actually be stoned. But that turns out to be wrong because the active agent's going to hang around because it's in your fat and it just keeps coming out. At a level, it's not going to affect your performance. So a regular user is always going to test positive, whether he's stoned or not. And the saving grace here from the point of view of the users is that cops don't like taking blood. There's no – the urine test is obviously irrelevant for this purpose. So the law requires a blood test. Cops will do anything they can to avoid doing that.
And that's pretty intrusive too.
And it's pretty intrusive.
Especially just as a screening mechanism. If you pull someone over and you don't know if they're drunk or you don't know if they're high on pot, just to give them a blood test just to see, I can imagine the lawsuits.
Well, it can't be done. The cops are not qualified. They have to take somebody to the hospital. So they're not going to do it, right? They're basically going to observe somebody driving oddly, pull them over, do a field sobriety test, do a breathalyzer. If he's negative on the breathalyzer, then they may wonder whether he's been using something else. It would be great to have an impairment test. The problem with an impairment test is you need a baseline. You need to know how the person behaves normally, because otherwise you're going to wind up convicting people of driving while intoxicated because they're sleepy or because they're old. Here's the issue in my view. Drunk driving is a problem not merely because alcohol impairs judgment and coordination and reaction time. It does all those things, and so does pot, maybe not quite to the same level. But alcohol is really dangerous not because people are a little slow and stupid, but because they're a little mean and aggressive. It's the mean drunks. It's the high-speed crash that causes the fatalities. That doesn't seem to be characteristic of cannabis. So I'm pretty relaxed about the stoned driving issue. I don't think there's going to be a lot of bloodshed with it. The real problem is that we talk about these drugs as if they were used separately. They're often used together. Mm-hmm. And they used together, they seem to be more than additively dangerous.
Let's take another call. Mark in Westchester. You're on WNYC. Mark, thank you for calling in.
Much. A fantastic show. It's wonderful to hear this discussion. My 23-year-old son, who is now clean, has been clean for about a year and a half and working full-time and doing well, suffered under addiction to marijuana for years. It is an incredibly dangerous and incredibly debilitating drug. There's no other way of looking at it. As a parent who's gone through this, I can tell you this is the case. But that being said, what is the state of Washington doing, if anything, to dissuade people, particularly young people, from using this horrific drug, which is what we're talking about?
It's really a great question, and it's such a complicated question because, again, like alcohol, you have alcohol commercials on TV and in all kinds of media all the time, at the same time that you have constant media campaigns warning people against the dangers of irresponsible alcohol use. So do you see something similar to that coming in Washington State for marijuana?
Certainly. Everybody who's doing drug prevention in Washington State is now going to have to rethink what they're doing. That's not under the board's jurisdiction, and therefore we may not be advising on that. One thing you get with alcohol is you walk down the street and you see signs for bars and liquor stores. If you're trying to quit drinking, you've got to reject 50 offers of a drink every day walking down the street in New York. Whether the board can use its regulatory power to minimize the amount of signage, I think is a good question. But I think I think what the caller said is very important. So for him, for his son, marijuana is a ferociously dangerous drug. And there's a lot of nonsense about how marijuana isn't addictive. It's not addictive if you don't get addicted to it. If you do, most addictive drugs don't cause addiction in most of the people who use them. Addiction is always a minority response to any drug except tobacco in the form of cigarettes.
But do we have to define addiction here? Because many people, I think, will say that heroin is addictive, or some of the painkillers that people use now, prescription drugs that they get addicted to, are physically, biochemically addictive in a way that marijuana is not.
Okay. That's a standard account, and I think it's not quite the right account. It's true that the opiates and opioids, heroin and the prescription painkillers, the benzos like Valium, Xanax, barbiturates cause a physical withdrawal syndrome. If you've been using for a while and you stop, you actually feel sick to your stomach. And when cocaine came in, people said, well, cocaine's not addictive because people who stop using cocaine don't jones. They don't go into delirium tremens or cold turkey, right? But that turned out to be a mistake. It turns out that addiction is really a property of behavior, not a property of whether there's a physical withdrawal syndrome.
So let me ask you a related question about Washington State, because I read an interview you did with the Washington Post in which you said that one of the big questions in Washington State is how to keep the prices up for cannabis. Now, you would think, hey, government should want to make things affordable for people if government's going to play a role at all. But there seems to be a minimization of use reason for government to be concerned with keeping cannabis prices high. Do I have that right?
Yes. And again, this is my view. This is not necessarily the board's view. For any of these activities that form a bad habit in a substantial number of people who engage in them, and we can make a list. They've been illegal at some times. They've been legal at other times. But just deciding to make them legal doesn't take the addictive risk away. And so we should manage these commodities differently from the way we manage other commodities. I mean, look, it's possible to get
addicted. And we already tax cigarettes partly in order to put their use out of use for some people.
And we don't tax alcohol nearly enough. The alcohol tax is so absurdly low given the amount of damage that problem drinkers do to themselves and other people. The single best crime control measure we could take in the U.S., much better than any gun control measure, would be to triple the federal alcohol tax. That would be a 6% reduction in homicides tomorrow. So, yes, I think that commodities that form bad habits need to be treated differently in regulation than other commodities. Like it's possible to form an addiction to shoes. Imelda Marcos did. But that's rare enough so that we can make shoe policy, mostly to keep shoes cheap and available. I don't think alcohol or cannabis are like that. And just deciding to make them legal should mean we want to encourage their use.
So what's an ounce of pot going to cost in Washington State and with what kind of a tax?
The taxes are in the law.
The taxes are in the law.
25% is sold from the producer to the distributor. 25% is sold from the distributor to the retailer. 25% is sold from the retailer to the customer, plus sales tax. You can't just add those up. It's going to come to about a third of what the customer pays is going to go back to the state. Then the question is, what's the customer going to pay? If the drug were fully legal, if they didn't have to worry about federal enforcement, it'd be astoundingly cheap. John Calkins at Carnegie Mellon, who's the first author on that book, calculated that if we were growing pot like corn, a joint would cost pennies. In the medical, not legally a sales system, but in fact sales are going on in Washington State, it's trading for around $10 a gram. That's $300 an ounce. That's less than the current illicit price for high-potency cannabis. In California, the medical dispensaries are selling $12 to $15 a gram. Seems to me the stuff that the board regulates has to compete with a purely illicit market and with this medical system. And it seems to me it wants to price, insofar as its regulations can influence price, wants to get about the same price, not much lower to encourage drug abuse, not much higher because you don't want to drive people back into the illicit market. It's not an easy line to draw.
It'll be a few dollars a dose then, right? A few dollars a
joint.
Yeah. I mean, a joint today costs maybe $4.
Yeah.
I don't see any reason to move that. I mean, anybody who wants to get stoned, the Doritos are going to cost more than the pot.
Last thing, because this has been in the news. The Liquor Control Board voted to create rules prohibiting marijuana use in bars and pubs in Washington state. So this is not going to be Amsterdam. And this happened after a few establishments started to create private pot smoking areas. That is in the, you know, the back room of the bar, something like that.
Right.
So pot bars legal, but not if they also sell alcohol, or no pot bars of any kind.
The rule in law is that the retailer may not offer the material can't be consumed where it's bought. And the liquor board can keep it out of the bars.
It's a right? pack. It's going to be a package store.
It's going to be a package store. But if you wanted to set up a music club that was a technically private club where people had to pay admission and let people smoke pot at the table, not clear to me the liquor board could control that. And not fully clear to me that's a terrible idea unless people are driving home.
We are just about out of time. We have more to do on the show this hour, and next we're going to talk to one of the leaders of the New York City Department of Education about these Common Core standardized tests that are coming for the first time next week. Apparently, they have not yet been teaching to those tests, but they are going to administer those tests. So we will bring in our guest on that in just a minute. Last question for Mark Kleiman. The U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder met with Washington and Colorado state officials to talk about this dilemma you mentioned at the outset. Washington state has now voted to legalize committing a felony under federal law. How are they going to smooth that?
Good question.
Is it just by Washington looking the other way?
No, there's actually a way to smooth it, and I don't know whether it's under consideration or not. The Controlled Substances Act, the law that makes marijuana illegal, has a specific provision for the Attorney General to enter into binding contractual agreements with state, local, and tribal authorities for the enforcement of that law. And it's possible to imagine essentially a treaty between the federal government and Washington state that says, here are our joint enforcement priorities around cannabis in Washington. Number one is multinational violent organized crime groups. Number two is export out of state. Number three is large-scale illegal for-profit enterprises. And then the stuff that's legal under Washington law would be a low federal enforcement priority. That wouldn't guarantee anybody that they wouldn't get prosecuted, but it would allow the system to work. Whether that's going to happen or not, I don't know.
Mark Kleiman is professor of public policy at the UCLA School of Public Affairs. He is the co-author of Marijuana Legalization, What Everyone Needs to Know, and he is now euphemistically known as Washington State's first pot czar, the first czar of anything not to draw a salary.
Correct.
Thank you very much for coming.
Brian, always a pleasure.
Brian Lehrer and WNYC, and coming up next, Common Core tests without Common Core curriculum. Stay with us.